Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. What leadership lessons help make you more effective? In this episode, Franklin Planner creator Hiram Smith speaks with Lewis Center director Doug Poe about leading with purpose, as well as practical, transformational leadership lessons.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I am Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Hiram Smith, the creator of the Franklin Planner. Our focus for this podcast is value management. Hiram, happy you're joining us today, and I want to begin by just asking you, what are you reading now or have read recently that is influencing your thinking on leadership?
Well, thank you. It's really nice to be with you. I'm honored to be invited to be on this podcast. I have been developing over the years some very strong feelings about the power of servant leadership. And Ken Blanchard, who is a very dear friend of mine, has written a couple of things titled Servant Leadership. And he is very faith-based in his beliefs and how he thinks that business works best, and I happen to agree with him. I believe that the best leaders in America are those who feel a need to serve the people that work for them. And I think that's the way the Savior lived. I think that's what he taught. And I don't think there's a better example on the planet than that. And so my thinking about leadership is if people can discover the power of wanting to serve the people that they manage rather than just manage them, that all kinds of miracles happen in the workplace.
I agree with you, and I appreciate you bringing up servant leadership because I think it's important. Do you have any thoughts in terms of servant leadership of how individuals can sort of not fall into this trap of believing they're a servant leader, but the reality is they're still really expecting people to sort of serve them? How do we make sure that we really are being servant leaders and not simply sort of talking a good talk but not walking the walk?
Yeah, I think it's, and that's an interesting trap that you've discovered, that you've described, that people I think can fall into. They get the impression, well, I gave my people a bonus, so therefore I'm a servant leader.
Right.
And that's not what servant leadership is about. Servant leadership is deep down in your core. You have a deep love and respect for the people that are working with you, for you, with you, around you. It's a basic respect for the human being as a son or daughter of God. And, you know, how do you acquire that? You need to start really believing that deep down inside, that these people are people. These are human beings, and they're if you have a genuine love for them, then you will be a servant leader. And, you know, I had an interesting experience a lot of years ago in the early days of Franklin. One of my consultants came in one day, and these are people that taught our seminar, and we were training 20, actually over 60,000 people a month in the peak of our success in live seminars. We had 150 full-time presenters, and they were very good. And this fellow was one of the best presenters I had. And he came in and he said, Hiram, I don't think I can do this again. I said, the thought of having to go do another seminar just makes me sick. And I said, well, really? I said, and then I asked him a question that really set him back. I said, when you walk into a class and you're about to start teaching the seminar, do you find yourselves counting the number of heads in the room and then multiplying it by your commission factor? And he said, how'd you know I do that? And I said, well, that's because while you're there for the money. You're not there to serve. You're not there to change their lives. This curriculum that you're teaching has the power of changing lives in a significant way. But if you're there because of the money, you'll tell the seminar, you won't teach it. And there's a big difference between telling and teaching. And I said, if you can't learn to love the people that you're teaching, then you need to get out of this business. Because, and I had done the seminar at that point over 2,000 times, and I have never lost the need. Every time I get up to speak, I have this unbelievable need to be as good today as I have ever been, because this is a new group of people and they're hungry to be taught. And I just discovered that this love thing is not just something you talk about in church on Sunday. It's a very real phenomenon that creates unbelievable power when you're doing what you're doing because you love the people you're working with.
I think that was powerful. And I want to come back to this difference between telling and teaching, but I do want to go ahead and pick up on, you mentioned Franklin Planner, and of course, you are one of the individuals who started Franklin Planner. And right. I just want to admit that I still have my original Franklin Planner with all of its inserts stowed away nicely.
Good.
So I am a big fan of the Franklin Planner. But can you just share a brief background on how you started Franklin Planner and why you think it did become so popular here in the United States?
Sure. I need to go back way. When I was 19 years old, I was in London, England, doing a two-year mission for my church, and I had the opportunity of spending about 30 minutes at the feet of Winston Churchill. And it was just 2 years before his death. This was in 1963. And it was just a small group. And I don't remember how I lucked into this, but he was just kind of visiting. He wasn't giving a big talk, but he said, you know, he said, I was obsessed from birth that I was put on the planet to make a difference. And then he said, almost wistfully, he said, you know, I hope I've made a difference. And I sat there thinking, are you kidding me? You saved the free world.
Oh, right. Yes. Right.
You know, I think you made a difference. But it was like a baton was passed to me that day that, you know, I was put on the planet to make a difference too. And so I that obsession began growing in me. Well, you know, I went through school and I started college, and then I got drafted in the army. Spent 4 years in uniform during the Vietnam conflict, and then I came back to finish school. I was married then. I had three children, and I went to work for ADP out of New York, Automatic Data Processing, a great firm. And Frank Lautenberg, a dear friend of mine, who started that company. And then in 1981, I had this desire to teach. I had always had this desire to teach, and I looked at the academic world, and I didn't have the credentials to teach in the academic world, so I decided I'd teach in the corporate world, because they'll take anybody in the corporate world. And you know, I had this passion about trying to help people get better control of their lives. And so a friend of mine, Dick Winwood, and I created a little company, and this was the first name of the company. It was H.W. Smith and Associates. I really liked that name. I thought that was a cool name. and then it was a time management. We had created a time management seminar because we really believed that we could teach people how to get control of their lives. And we believed that the base, that if people had a reason to be more productive, then they would find a way to be more productive. And so we created a value-based time management system that started with, you know, we had this productivity pyramid, and there are four pieces to it. And the base of the pyramid was to identify your governing values, what matters most to you. And then put that in writing, and that would become your personal constitution. And once you knew that, then you could do, the next step was long-range goals, then intermediate goals. And then the top of the pyramid was, today, what am I going to do today about what matters most to me? And, you know, our Trojan horse was time management, but I'll bet over the 40 years, I've had 1,000 people come to me and say, you know, Hiram, you're teaching life management. Why don't you admit it? And I said, well, actually, we are teaching life management, but if we market it as life management, nobody'd come.
Right, right.
And so we call it time management, and then people come, and then we sneak in the back door and say, you know, if you want to get control of your life, you've got to find out who you are. Write your own constitution. What matters most to you? And now all of a sudden, you've discovered a wonderfully powerful ability to say no. And what does that mean? That means as things come up that don't mix with my value system, I can say no to it. Most people can't. They just live in the reactive world. And so we our whole thing was to get people out of the reactive mode into the proactive mode. And one of the most important things, and this is really, to me, means a lot. And there are three basic emotions that motivate us to do what we do. In fact, in any point of the day, you'll discover that you're functioning from one of these three emotions. And I'll start with the lower one. The first emotion is fear. And the feelings that surface at this level are, I have to do this. Now, some of us go to work out of fear. I have to go. And if I don't go, I'll get fired, family will starve, all that's bad. I still go to work. The job gets done to a degree. But the motive is fear. Some of us take our wives out to dinner out of fear. You know, if I don't take my wife to dinner, things will get bad. So I take, you know, I have to do it. The next emotion, the next higher emotion that motivates activity is the emotion of duty. And the feelings that surface here are, I ought to do this. So, you know, fear is have to, duty is I ought to. Some of us go to work because we ought to do it. I mean, we've been raised with the ethic that says, give a full day's effort for a full day's pay. And so we go. Some of us take our wives to dinner out of duty. She's my wife, takes care of my kids. I really ought to do it, and so I do it. Job gets done to a degree. The highest emotion that motivates activity in our lives is the emotion of love. And the feelings that surface here are, I want to do this. So it's fear, have to, duty, ought to, love, I want to do this. And if you want a sobering experience, just step back and say, you know, right now we're on a podcast together. Which of the emotions is motivating me to do this? Am I doing this because I have to, I ought to, or I want to? I'm guessing that you're here because you want to. Frankly, I wouldn't be here if I didn't want to be here.
Right, that's right.
It's no fun. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense.
And so that's the whole idea of moving from reactive to proactive is I want to be engaged in things that I really want to do because I love doing it. And if I can make that transition, I call it the journey from fear to love. And we manage that. I never could, you know, when I was changing my kids' diapers, you know, 40 years ago, and I never could get that quite past duty.
Right.
But at least I was aware that I'm doing this out of duty. Does that right. make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And I want to pick up on that a little bit and you've already started into sort of value management. And think about the church and sort of not only pastors, but lay. And it seems to me in what you just described that one of the challenges in the church is we often do things either out of fear or out of duty, but we're not doing it out of love. Mm-hmm. And would you do you think that's correct? And do you have any insights that can help us think about it differently?
Yeah, I think that is correct, but that's just not true in the church. I think that's true in life, and there are a lot of people who spend their lives functioning at the lower level. I have to do this, and they're very unhappy. And you know, one of the sobering things to think about, put this into a management context. You manage people the same way. You can manage with fear, you can manage with duty, and you can manage with love. That's the servant leadership thing. You know, that's the end. Did you ever read Jim Collins' book, Good to Great?
Yes, a while ago.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's an old book. And I know Jim Collins, a great guy. And through his extensive research, he discovered the level five leader. And, you know, everybody talks about the first four levels of leadership. And he talked about Jack Welch and all these guys who were level four managers and leaders. And they created great companies. But then he discovered that there were very few level five leaders. And the one ingredient that was made the difference between a level four and level five leader was humility. And it was surprising. I was at lunch with him one day, and he said, you know, I was surprised by that. And I said, well, I said, Jim, what's define humility? And, you know, he really didn't have it. He couldn't define it. And I said, can I give you my definition of humility? And he said, sure. I said, my definition of humility is the realization of our dependence on God.
That's powerful.
And the minute I accept and internalize the fact that I am dependent on my Father in heaven for everything I have or will have, humility sneaks in the back door. You never can recognize it yourself. You're being too grateful for the fact that you're dependent on God. And when that dependence becomes real in your life, now you start to show up because you want to be there, not because you have to be. And I will tell you, when a pastor is delivering a sermon in any church, if he or she is there because they have to or ought to, the people in the congregation can tell. Do you believe that?
Oh, I absolutely believe it. I've heard it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you can sit there. I mean, a lot of people aren't going to say, well, he's here out of fear today, but they know that he's not here out of love, you know? Yeah. And that's an internal battle that people have to fight. And I think before, you know, every time I get up to speak, and I speak a lot, and, you know, I'm still on the speaking show. In fact, I was in Nashville last week, and it was neat because in Nashville, they're still starting business meetings with prayer, which I thought was fabulous, you know? But I found every time I walk up to the podium before I speak, I just say a little prayer. And I said, God, I need to have you with me, because if I don't have you with me, I'm not going to be able to reach these people's spirit. And I'll tell you, the difference it makes in my delivery is unbelievable. You know, I call it the fast gun syndrome. There have been a lot of great writers who were terrible speakers. And I think they get the impression that, well, because I have a world-class best-selling book, that people are going to hang on every word I say. It's not true. And, you know, the gunfighter in the Old West had to be fast every time or he died.
That's correct. That's right.
And that's true of a speaker or a preacher. You've got to be as good right now as you've been ever in your life, because these people are new. So you've got to be fast every time. And so as I coach some speakers, I say, you know what? If you're not fast every time, you're going to be dead. They'll walk out. And they do, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Staying in the mode of sort of speaking, and you talked about this earlier, the difference between telling and teaching. And it seems to me that love is certainly connected to this, is that when you love something, it's genuinely teaching it. How do you, and this would be true for a sermon also, I mean, how do you, let me ask it this way, are there things you can do to try to make sure you don't cross the line into telling? You know, it seems to me for all of us, the more you do something, it would be easier just sort of to, you know, it either becomes rote or you become a little bit lazy and it becomes telling more than teaching.
Yeah. Well, I think the bottom line here is, if you're not living what you're teaching, then you're going to be telling, because you're giving experiences that other people have had, not experiences that you have had. And I give you a great example of that. We taught people for 40 years that they ought to have their own personal constitution. That means you identify your governing values, and remind me to tell you about the I-beam experience, the I-beam story. But we teach people to identify their governing values, put them in writing, and then this becomes this is who you are. Okay? Well, if you're a presenter of this and you're telling people that they ought to have their own constitution, but you don't have one of your own, they're not going to believe you.
I'm with you.
It's
yes.
Just that simple.
Right.
And, you know, I've had hundreds of people after seminars come in, you know, was there any chance you'd let me see your constitution? And so I actually put it in the back of one of my books. In fact, I think I put it in the 10 Natural Law of Time Management book, right? In one of my recent books called The Three Gaps, I put my constitution in the back so people would see what one looked like, you know?
Absolutely.
So it's a matter of walking the talk. I mean, the reason the Savior was so powerful is that he lived everything he taught. And so he was teaching, not telling. But if you're telling somebody, if you're teaching somebody about integrity and you are scamming people out of their money, you know, it just doesn't work.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I want to talk a little bit about the 10 natural laws. There are a couple that I think are particularly helpful for individuals in congregation, particularly leaders. You talk about to reach any goal, you must leave your comfort zone. How can leaders leave their comfort zone? I think people often sort of talk about that in different ways, but the reality is all of us sort of get into this place where we feel comfortable and it's hard to get us outside of that because we're afraid of failure or we're afraid of what may happen. So how do you help people to actually, you know, step outside of their comfort zone?
Well, the thing, you know, we need to come back to this whole idea of writing down your values. The one thing people need to remember is there's such a thing that I like to call the tyranny of the familiar. Mm-hmm. And because we've lived this certain way all our lives, and you know, how do I break out of the familiar? And if we really have a good sense in writing of what our values are, then we, you know, what we then have to face are the gaps between what I'm doing and what my values are. That's why I wrote this Three Gaps book. And mm-hmm. one of the gaps is the value gap. Now here's the seal. If one of my governing values is to be physically fit and I weigh 400 pounds, I'm in pain. You know, whenever there is a gap, then I'm in pain. Well, if I want inner peace, what have I got to do? I've got to close that gap. I've got to bring my weight down to where it makes sense. If I value being financially okay and I'm $500,000 in debt, I'm in pain. And so how do I bring that back? Well, I've got to get out of a comfort zone. If I'm going to lose 250 pounds, I've got to walk away from a major comfort zone. And that means I've probably been sitting around on my fanny watching TV and eating most of my life. And so I've got to get up and get out of that. Until I decide that that really matters to me, I won't leave that comfort zone. I'm stuck. And so the whole idea is I've got to identify what really matters to me. And the reason people don't sit down and find out what really matters to them is because if they do, then they have to face the gaps. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And to shift the analogy a little bit, a lot of particularly mainline congregations are struggling and declining. But even though they're in decline, they're sort of comfortable with the decline because basically the church is still there for them, although they claim they want to grow. But what you're just saying is that they haven't gotten to that place yet where they really have to face the gap and really make a decision. We're going to do the things to turn around the decline we're facing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really interesting. You know, if we have declining congregations, which we do, we know that, well, what can I do about that? And there tends to be one of the other gaps in these three gap books I wrote is the belief gap. And, you know, and the question that's answered here is there a gap between what I believe is true and what is actually true? And if there is, I'm in pain. I mean, if I believe gravity only works in the morning, then I'm going to have a problem in the afternoon.
That's right. Yes.
And so, I've got to find out, is my belief system in line with reality? And if I believe in my heart that there's nothing I can do about the declining congregation, then I will be right. I won't do anything about it. But if I believe that I've got a message here that will change people's lives, that they'll be better, more productive, happier, have better relationship with their spouses, which, by the way, is what the Savior taught. I mean, you know, if all of the churches basically are based in the idea that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, taught stuff that works. And I tell a lot of people, I say, you know, whether you believe Christ is the Son of God or not, I happen to believe he is, but whether you do that, the fact is what he taught works. You know, you have better families, you have better relationship with your children if you're living the principles that the Savior taught. And so the sad thing is, we have the answer to all the problems in our country in our churches. And if I really believe that, then I'm going to go out and find a way to, if you'll come to church, you'll find something that will help you be a better father, a better mother, a better brother or sister, a better grandmother, better grandfather. I personally think that tide can be turned. But the scary thing, quite frankly, is that, we're becoming a godless society. And, in Europe, they're closing cathedrals. Yes. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, or they're becoming museums.
That's right. And that's the only way they can survive is by turning them into a museum.
Yeah. There was one more law in there that really struck me. And it says, give more and you will have more. And again, I'm struck by this because I think in many cases, our minds work the opposite way. We always feel like we have to sort of be very frugal with our resources. Mm-hmm. How do we help individuals to really live into generosity?
Okay. I this is something I have some really strong feelings about. Let me tell you a story that taught me a marvelous thing. Quite a few years ago, I was asked to speak in Denver at a corporate gathering, and this guy's company started his company. It was very successful, and he asked me to speak after dinner at his annual meeting. So I flew to Denver, and he picked me up in a Rolls Royce and drove me to his home where we had dinner, and it was the most beautiful home I think I'd ever seen. And he told me as we walked in that this home cost $8 million, for some reason, it was important that I know that.
Right.
And then he took me on a tour of the house, and there were $3.5 million worth of art in this house. And I know that because he felt like I should know that too.
Right. Right.
And then I went. We had a nice dinner, and I spoke at his convention, and I got on my airplane to fly home. And as I flew back, I found I had two very interesting, powerful, and seemingly opposite emotions. The first emotion was, gee, I wonder if he could get by on a $2 million home or a $1.5 million home. Take the difference and do something with it that matters.
Right.
But then the other feeling that came in on me was, well, wait a second. I would defend his right to have that $8 million home with my life. That's what America is all about. And then I had a big aha. Do you know what an aha is?
Absolutely.
It's the highest form of a buffo. Do you know what a buffo is?
No.
It's a blinding flash of the obvious.
Okay.
And the buffo was, the minute you are able to look in the mirror and say to yourself, I have sufficient for my needs, at that point, you are wealthy.
Mm.
Why? Because you have enough. And if you're successful or bright enough and lucky enough to have created more than is sufficient for your needs, the difference between what is sufficient for your needs and what you have is a stewardship that the Lord has given you to do something with that matters. Well, I got pretty excited about that whole idea, and I call it the abundance mentality. And there are two basic mentalities on the planet. One is the scarcity mentality. And the scarcity mentality you've described, there's not enough on the planet for everybody. Therefore, I've got to grab what I can and hold on to it. The abundance mentality, the other side of the coin, is that, well, there's plenty on the planet for everyone. Therefore, I can share what I have. And you can tell, which mentality is bigger than the other. Okay, the scarcity mentality.
Yes.
But the whole idea, so I started giving talks about this all around the country. It was really kind of fun because I've been talking about time management forever. And so I started giving this abundance mentality thing. And this is an easy talk to give when you're broke. And because why? Because you're talking to somebody else,
That's right.
Well, in 1992, and on June 3rd of 1992, I found myself standing on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. My wife, all my children, and their spouses were with me, and we were there to see our company come up on the board as a public company for the first time. And it was about 9:15 in the morning. I don't know if you've been on the floor of the stock exchange, but it's bedlam. I mean, you can raise a piece of paper and destroy Brazil. It's just, you know, it's chaos. But anyway, so there's a lot of noise. And all of a sudden, up on the big board came FNQ, which was our call sign then, Franklin Quest, $16.50 a share. And I did a quick mental calculation of the number of shares I owned times 1650, and I started to sweat. And, you know, I gathered my family together. I said, you know, and then the little voice in the back of my head, this is a very real experience, little voice in the back of my head said, well, Hiram, are you going to put your money where your mouth has been? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, so I gathered my kids around. I said, you know, I'm having a really bad experience here this morning. I said, I've been giving this talk about the abundance mentality. If you have sufficient for your needs, then whatever is over that, you have a right to, you have an obligation to do something with it that matters. Anyway, to make a long story short, my wife and I made a commitment that morning on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange that we would die broke. And now my kids were not excited about that.
I'm sure they were.
And so we decided to test the principle. You know, there's a wonderful scripture that says, you know, cast your bread on the water and it comes back tenfold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's not a – I don't think that's there as fodder for a talk on Sunday. I think that's a natural law of the universe. So we started to test that principle and we decided what was sufficient for our needs. We have a lovely home and, you know, it's a very nice home. It's not, you know, ostentatious, but it's a lovely home. We live on a ranch, and we're very comfortable, but we had more than was sufficient for our needs. So we started doing stuff, and we did a lot of stuff. We gave away a ton of money. In fact, there's an arts facility here in southern Utah that, you know, because of the arts facility, I only have 3 months to live. But we've tested the principle, and you know what? It works. You know, we have done extremely well, but we've also been given the opportunity to do stuff that matters because we have more than is sufficient for our needs. And so the whole issue is, and it's back to the love thing, you know? It all comes back at some point to love, and that's what the Savior taught. And that is if you love your family and you love people and you love the Lord, you're going to find ways to serve your family and other people and the Lord. And we know for a fact that when we're serving other people, we are only serving our Father in heaven, because that's what He's asked us to do. And, you know, the whole thing, you know, love one another, that's the bottom line of what He taught.
Absolutely.
All I want you to do is be my friend and love each other, you know?
Yes.
So that's the question that people need to ask. They need to stand in front of the mirror and say, do I have sufficient for my needs? And, you know, for this guy, his needs may have been an $8 million home. That's his decision, not mine.
Right.
But he had more than that. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So he was certainly capable of doing it. I have no idea what he was doing philanthropically. He was probably doing some great things. Mm-hmm. But that's none of my business.
Right.
But the fact is, if we believe in the abundance mentality, then we'll give.
Hiram, as we get ready to conclude, I want to sort of end with, are there any other sort of insights that you would want to share? I have, I could go on all day long. You know, I love the stories of one about Churchill is just incredible and amazing. I just can't imagine what it would be like to actually have met Churchill.
Yeah, it was, you know, I wish I knew then what I know now about Churchill.
Yes. But any other insights you would like to share with us?
Well, I think the bottom line for me, and I think the bottom line for our success is that we were in the business to help other people get control of their lives. And that was our focus. And we were never in it for the money. And you know, a lot of people don't believe that because we ended up making a ton of money. But and then we, you know, we're doing stuff with that that I think is appropriate. But I think if you are in it for yourself, you are, you know, you're in trouble. And I did a thing on a long time ago. I was asked by a bunch of reporters what I attributed to the success of Franklin, what became Franklin Covey. And I discovered that there were 8 ingredients, but one of them, I'll just share one of them, and this is that money must always be the byproduct of some other success.
That makes sense.
Money must always be the byproduct of some other success. And our focus really was genuinely, I think we can teach people how to get control of their lives. And we would ask people to write us a letter 21 days after they went through our seminar. We got hundreds of thousands of letters telling us how their lives had changed because they really had gotten involved with finding out what their values were and then ordering their lives around their values and closing gaps. And that was very exciting to us, you know. And then all of a sudden we looked around and said, holy cow, we're making a lot of money, right. You know. So I think that's the one thing. Money must always be the byproduct of some other success.
Yeah. Well, Hiram, I really appreciate your taking the time. This has been fantastic.
My pleasure.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Discovering God's Future for Your Church. This turnkey video toolkit helps your congregation discern and implement God's vision for your church's next faithful steps. Discovering God's Future for Your Church is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Dan Turner speaks with Lewis Center Associate Director Ann A. Michael about how his Washington, D.C. church chose to discontinue its ministry to start a new, more fruitful congregation in the same place.
And so the first step that we did, there was a vote taken to basically turn complete control, all decision-making, over to this outside entity that we called an advisory board at the time, outside advisory board. There were, other than myself, there were no members of the congregation on the board. And it was a really healthy, forward-thinking group that had one objective, and that objective was to get this church into a place where they can reach this community for Christ. And so every change that was going to be happening, I could have recorded it and just pressed play, but every time somebody would say, well, why is the music like this, or why are you doing this, I would just say it over and over again. This is not about sustaining this church. It's about reaching this community for Christ.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.